are in grave danger at this point as a civilization, because the cybernetic revolution predicted by Norbert Wiener was a far less friendly future than he predicted. We are essentially living now, it would seem, in a cybernetic civilization that's at risk of a total loss of human freedom if this move towards a psycho-civilized society where mind control and brain and body implants become ubiquitous. Let me also just, because I don't think Vinny is now with us.
I am.
Oh, you are. Sorry, Vin. I just want to say, just to qualify, that I don't refute anything that Mr. Irvin may have said about the danger posed to society and our children by psychotronic devices. That's part of his narrative, and I don't want to rebut that. I agree with him. In fact, I said that when I volunteered to appear with him on the Michael Vera show to try to use a Gandhian approach to resolving any conflict that he might have perceived that he had with me, because he had essentially held me accountable for somehow not covering this fact. When I was narrating my childhood experiences in Pegasus, somehow he had mistakenly presupposed that I was the Martin Luther King of mind control and trying to prevent the onslaught of a psycho-civilized society. In fact, I ended my mind control research in 2002 when the victims I was helping as a lawyer began to attack me under the fallacious notion that I was a government operative of some kind, because I was sharing my experiences in Pegasus, at least initially, during those years. So I don't want to rebut anything he said. I think we are what he claims to have detected. I don't know what he said on your show because I haven't monitored what he said, but he was talking about the fact that he had detected psychotronic devices on school playgrounds in California. And of course, we had Mae Brussels, brilliant prognosticative discussions of what she called, the old great conspiracy theorist Mae Brussels, referred to what she called the California terrors. She believed that Ronald Reagan, when he was not yet president, but was when he was governor of California, in funding a prison project to try to abate violence in society, including amongst society's disaffected individuals, had led to the creation of a mind control program in which specific school gunmen and the like had been brainwashed to attack the civilian population so that fascist totalitarian police measures could be imposed against the civilian population. Well, that seems to be the world that we're now living in with these Sandy Hook and these Aurora and these Columbine type shootings. I mean, imagine how inured to the preciousness of human life these young gunmen have been. They've been behaving as what Alfred has described as human robots. In fact, some of the survivors of these school shootings have said, when he shot me, I was looking right in his eyes, and it was like I was looking into the eyes of a robot. Now, on the political side, if we look at the use of cybernetic and mind control technologies regarding national leaders, I hope we've all seen the footage of Bill Clinton, where he's sitting with an ashen face, completely unresponsive with his eyes open, as if he's some kind of automaton who's been programmed to wake up and act president.
Now, we're just connecting Suzanne Posel from Occupy Corporatism. She should be coming in.
All right. So we also have the issue of the, I don't know what we would call it, but the area on the back of George W. Bush's jacket. He was seen to have had something installed between his shoulder blades. We also have the video and photographic evidence of two Barack Obamas, one who seems to have had some kind of surgery to his head, because the one Barack Obama has areas where the head has been shaved along certain lines. We have Alfred's reporting about the fact that somebody at a presidential appearance encountered a Bill Clinton lookalike that was 5'9", not 6'1", as President Clinton is. So we really have to begin, I think, to approach rationally the issue of what has been done to psycho-civilize society. One of the impediments here I found when I did my mind control research in the early 20s eras is that the mind control claimants' accounts tend to track the claims of delusional individuals who are victims of trauma, of paranoid schizophrenia for organic reasons, and to include, I don't mean to seem disrespectful to women, to also include menopausal women whose menopause has affected their the chemistry of their brains and hence their cognition. But I found, and I actually networked with some of the progenitors of these mind control technologies, and I did establish that psychotronic technology by the year 2000 could be purchased on the open market. That is to say, technology that you could use to completely enslave an individual or to brainwash them and do something against their will, like have sex with you or take you to their bank so you could steal their entire account. But that technology by 2000, having been pioneered by Dr. Eldon Berg for the Navy, was now in the had gone black in spring of 1981, and from the early 80s was in the hands of the CIA, and from there into rogue elements of the intelligence community internationally, and then into organized criminal and terrorist networks. So that by the year 2000, somebody could purchase psychotronic technology to completely take over somebody's thoughts and behavior for only $150,000, which is certainly in the reach of many millionaires and centimillionaires and billionaires. So the world we're living in is, in all likelihood, one in which the financial elite have teams of specialists who actually use this technology to, for example, redirect stalkers. I thought it was conspicuous in the case of Kevin Perfield that his first target was Warren Buffett, and then one of his next targets, this is going back 15 years in the case of Perfield, was the attorney partner in Berkshire Hathaway of Buffett, namely Charlie Munger, who's the father of the political activist in California, Molly Munger, who's been trying to pass a tax to spend more money on education in California, same family. So I've kind of followed the mind control issue for over a decade. What Eldon told me is that he was going around the world to alert dedicated intellectuals, so college professors, attorneys, people in the media, that his technology had been taken over by the intelligence community and diverted into some very nefarious hands. And so, for example, if somebody's subjectively claiming that, let's say, they moved into a new apartment in San Diego, and that somebody began psychotronically bombarding them with voices, sound effects, and attempts to entrain them or just make their life miserable. Eldon said that as a threshold matter, you can't dismiss that kind of claim, although it may be from some other cause like fantasy, delusion, schizophrenia, that those experiences do occur to real people because the technology exists. But one of the confounding factors that he cited was what happened to Elizabeth Targ, the daughter of Russell Targ, and Fred Sitcher, her co-author on a distance healing academic study. What happened is that Elizabeth succumbed to the rare form of cancer that they used as the control in their distance healing experiment. And then Fred Sitcher began to hear sound effects behind his head. And Eldon not only identified them as sounding like if you could simultaneously record every prurient thought in a major metropolitan area of every last child molester and sexually perverted person and put them all in one room and then tape the audio effect. That's what he said it sounded like. But it, not only did he hear that about 6 inches behind Fred Sitcher's brainstem, but he taped it, and he was able to inform Fred that he wasn't going crazy, that it was real sound. So confounding the mind control literature is what Eldon described as something very close to what the novelist Philip K. Dick described in one of his novels, is a kind of an externalized sound effect that has the characteristics of a haunting, but that is coming from us interdimensionally in a psychotronic way. So this is a very complex area where we have interdimensional bombardment of a psychotronic nature, mind control ploys being directed against individuals by the government and corporate sector and the military and the intelligence community, but also then the misappropriation of the technology by criminals and terrorists, but then also unknown phenomena that is really of an origin that has not yet been identified. So it's a very complex area, and we really have to entertain all of the above when we ask, well, what is this specific claimant suffering from? What I ended up doing as an attorney is telling the individuals, look, I don't believe you're crazy. I believe that you're hearing things that are really there, but the problem is we can't prove who's injuring you, so there's no defendant. You know, in pure principle, there are defendants or a defendant who's doing this to you. They may be any of those things I just mentioned, but we can't establish that. In fact, even at the level of factual investigation, we don't know who to sue in tort because we haven't identified the defendant. I think that in a big way, where some of this is coming from, are the kind of labs that I was in as a kid on Project Pegasus. Let's just call them defense technical labs, because they are labs that have one foot in the corporate sector and one foot in the Defense Department. One pattern we can clearly identify is that when people become outspoken as whistleblowers, there is a set of psychological and medical symptoms that they've been suffering from. What I've been suffering from medically is very close to what the researchers around Jim Mars began to suffer from when they came together in Common Enterprise to help him write his books about 9/11, including Inside Job and I think the second one was called The Terror Conspiracy, something like that, The Terror or something. You know, constant dehydration, insomnia, neuropathic pain, dehydration, and these type of symptoms that I now have after speaking out about the U.S. time travel cover-up and the Mars cover. My guess would be that in this whole kind of bizarre, strange, Lovian 40-year love affair with psychotronic weaponry, what have been established are essentially intelligence community defense technical bases where specific people are being targeted. It's been alleged that that can be done by identifying the DNA signature of the target and even delivering these kinds of injuries from satellites. At this point, I don't doubt it, and I don't doubt Alfred's claim that there's even more complex and insidious delivery mechanisms that have emerged to essentially psycho-civilize the entire population through HARP and chemtrails and so forth. Because we're clearly dealing in a situation here where only, I would say, a minority of the population is even healthy enough spiritually and intellectually to fight back and to even discuss these matters. When I discuss my experiences, I frequently get absolutely no response from fellow Americans. It's almost as if anything that's outside the official script that's propagated by the news, by the schools, by the churches, by their family members, they can't even discuss non-ordinary experience, nor the very real threats that exist to their freedom. So I don't know what the answer is, except to still keep on fighting. I remember how Mae Brussel was always called a kook. She was denounced as a kook her entire career. But if you go back to Mae's broadcasts, some of them are utterly, utterly revelatory and contemporary in their
significance. Andy, could I jump in here?
Sure.
Because
sure,
I think the solution is simply to know what brainwashing techniques work. And repetition is apparently one of the strongest forms of brainwashing. So if you want people to know the truth about all of these kind of things, all you got to do is keep repeating it and repeating it and repeating it and repeating it, and eventually they'll think it's true. And incidentally, you can brainwash people with lies just as easy as you can convince them of the truth using that same tool.
Yeah, I think that's true. So keep stuff
Let me jump in here, and this is an area that I'd like to address to Andy, because Andy has declared that he's a candidate for the U.S. presidency in 2016, and this is actually a matter at the level of the U.S. president. And that is about 18 months ago, the current U.S. president, Barack Obama convened a commission to deal with these issues and actually brought in a number of what are called targeted individuals, that is, individuals who have been chipped, who went up and gave testimony. There were testimony from scientists, and that commission was to have issued a report. And what the individuals at the European experts that I interviewed over the last 10 days have said is that no report has come out from that commission. The targeted individuals have kind of been dropped and sort of treated shabbily by the so-called Obama Commission. And it's kind of gone, you know, it's sort of being pushed to the side. So I asked them, you know, that maybe this was a false initiative, because Obama issued a statement at the beginning of 2013 that he had a, quote, Manhattan Project, a new project which was the human brain, and that this was the new Manhattan Project. And I truly believe, having observed this man from many different perspectives, that he may be implementing a deceptive agenda, and that what he was promoting initially in 2013 or 2012 as the second Manhattan Project, the human brain, is really a Trojan horse around the transhumanist agenda, and that the presidential commission that he had was really a sideshow to suck in some token targeted individuals and scientists and then to kind of shove them aside, which it looks like what the case is. And so this looks like a presidential level agenda. And I'd like to address to Andy what he would do in terms of not only the campaign, but if and when he is elected president, to address this issue.
Hey there.
Andy? Sorry, Alfred. I was cleaning up my office here and I had the mute on. Sorry. I think that, you know, when I think about the most difficult public policy problems, you know, Bertrand Russell said there's fundamentally only three problems: the infinitely small, the infinitely large, and the infinitely complex. The problem with several major public policy issues, including this one, and I would also add the problem of pervasive irradiation of our planet by ionizing radiation sources, both civilian and military, is their complexity. I must admit that I don't have a silver bullet public policy answer to this problem, but I would say this. The critical thing we need at this stage is the most pervasive, reliable, sensate, clear, and truthful testimony about what's really happened. Because, for example, if you look at Ruth Badden's Committee on Mind Control, what was that? That was President Clinton's Advisory Committee on Human Subject Experimentation, or AICS, in 93. That committee even heard testimony from individuals who had been mind controlled in New Mexico, like Suzanne Starr's testimony, that seemed to indicate that she was either a witness or a participant in the classified activities of the defense technical community that I was brought into, and that implicated New Mexico in a major way. And yet there was no testimony before that commission of the reasons why specific members of our generation were brainwashed or put under entrainment. So, for example, there wasn't testimony from somebody. There was testimony by people who had been affected by MKUltra, but there was no testimony that, for example, they would mind control somebody and make them subject to entrainment, as they did in the famous Candy Jones case, so that the person could be used as a technical errand, where they would be put under entrainment, given sophisticated defense or given sophisticated technical information that they wouldn't even remember when they were taken out of their entrained state, used as an errand to deliver that information to somebody else, and then taken out of their hypnotized state. So what I'm saying here is that official government action by the last two Democratic presidents, namely Clinton and Obama, the defect in the public policy discourse that they sponsored is that it wasn't truthful enough in the sense that it wasn't deep enough and it wasn't advanced enough in light of that Bertrand Russell category of problematic realities of the infinitely complex. So the only thing I could say that would have, you know, the sagacity worthy of even pursuing the presidency would be to say that your proposal for a U.S. truth and amnesty program modeled on the South African example with that, I think that has to be the cornerstone of this area of my presidency, should I be privileged with the opportunity to serve as U.S. president, because what we don't have at the federal level is an open process where we really are in terms of the danger of these realities is, you know, if you assume arguendo that the Democratic presidents in the post-war era, you know, going back to FDR, let's say, or even Wilson, have been much more responsive to the interests of the people than the Republicans, not that much more, but more so, their experiments with transparency have, in a sense, been cover-ups. And that's what I would say is I would say that we have to find a way to so indemnify claimants from retaliation against them physically or against their pensions or protection from criminal prosecution that it has to become so utterly safe to be a truth teller that, for example, let's say our dear friend Loren Murray, the heroic activist in the radiation area, let's say Loren had already served as the director of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. I would want her to be so safe testifying from physical retaliation, psychotronic attack, poisoning, firing, deprivation of her federal pension or whatever, for her to be able to tell in open Senate testimony that the lifespan in the continental United States is going to be less in the next generation because of pervasive radiation. We're already noting the difference, for example, that Caucasians living in the United States have twice the incidence of dread diseases as people from Mexico who come to the United States in terms of diabetes, heart disease, and cancer. And that all can't be diet and attitude. I'm sorry. That's because the continental United States has been irradiated, and it's being irradiated even more with the Fukushima input. And radiation is deleterious to genetic health and to longevity and to current physical health. So what I'm saying is every time these truth-like initiatives get sponsored by the Democrats, they don't go into the areas of secret government operations. They vet the and publicly discuss the victimization aspect, but not the covert programs and how actually advanced they are and how serious the threats are on our freedom, our health, our lives, our communities, and so forth. So that's the best I can do, because I think in the case of some of these, what the intelligence community and what the military and the corporations have done is so sinister and so deeply embedded in their own activities that it's almost impossible to discern what the problems are in their complexity because of the constant denial of the up-to-date information. One of the things that distinguishes the gifted and talented students that I've spoken with that have come forward, not only myself, but Brett Stillings is an example. I was recently dating a woman here in Portland who had gone to a GATE program in Northern California, is during our careers in that black part of government, we were often astounded by what intelligence community people would tell us. For example, that they have ways of telling who you were in your former lives that are reliable, that are 100% reliable. Now, how could that be? Because in the civilian population, when you explore reincarnation, you might get a good reading from a hypnotherapist. And, well, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I could have been you know, that per, you know, that friend of Benjamin Franklin, blah, 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 right? Okay. But no, I'm saying that any of us who had contact with the career operatives in CIA have, you know, all at some times been absolutely astounded by what people in the CIA have revealed secretly or quietly to us about the actual intelligence capabilities. It's almost like we're all living in a dysfunctional family where the parents never tell anything important to the kid, but just manage them. And that's, I think that's the number one problem. In other words, when I run for president, it's going to be under the banner of truth, not truth that would invade individual privacy and not truth that would, for example, have the White House put how to build a nuclear weapon on the White House website. Definitely threats to individual privacy and freedom on the one hand, and revelations that would create a clear and present danger of harm to individuals in society don't need to be revealed.
Andy, I've got some bad news for you. You just lost your Goldman Sachs campaign contributions.
Oh damn. I was hoping to build that $7 million house in La Jolla next to Mitt Romney. So sorry. No, but
yeah, maybe Chase Manhattan also.
That's the answer I can give you, because I think the complexity is so severe that we will need several administrations of utter truth to even get a handle on these problems. They're that deeply embedded in the way government is actually functioning.
The whole system is built upon lies that are built upon lies that are built upon lies. And basically what we'd be talking about is multiple terms of U.S. presidents needing to gradually roll back almost everything that's been done to the United States legislation since, well, 1913, when the Federal Reserve Act and the IRS were put into place. Roll back the CIA. Roll back the Federal Reserve. Abolish the IRS. And so on and so forth. These aren't things that can really be accomplished overnight, are they?
Well, I'm going to be advancing a tax proposal. And I don't want to articulate it because I don't want to start defending it. But I'm going to advocate a certain kind of tax in a certain area of the banking community in which $13 trillion for federal spending could be raised. And all taxes, except for the one that would generate this trillion dollars would be the people would be unburdened from taxation. So there are ways of doing more creative taxation where we could essentially eliminate the federal income tax, the Fed, and the IRS, except they would serve the role as actual just straight on enforcement agents for just traditional evasion of federal taxation. But I'm saying that I am going to be attacking the financial conspiracy that's been waged against us since 1913. And people say, well, Lincoln and Kennedy and five other U.S. presidents were shot or poisoned for that, according to Sherman Skolnick, right? The late Sherman Skolnick, Jackson, and so forth. But I'm just not going to ride in, if I'm elected, I'm just not going to ride any open limousines when I do that. But I'll be armed myself, you know, a la Allende. But no, we have to attack that because there's no reason to even have a federal income tax. There's a relatively pain-free way that we can interpose a federal tax in the banking system so that people won't have to work from January to May 1st to make their own money. I mean, it's silly to have an economic system where money is the playing pieces and then you take half of somebody's money away and then ask them to be prosperous and productive. It's just asinine. I think so. That's definitely that's a more concrete reality that a president can articulate a vision and then accomplish something with Congress. But in this area of what Alfred was describing and how advanced it is now, I must be honest and say that I would lead with a truth and reconciliation process so that we can have the people who have been most deeply implicated in these realities testify in open Senate hearings. But then the policy solutions are very difficult. I mean, in the case of time travel, since ultimately anybody could teleport into anybody's living room and anybody could retrieve any kind of personal imagery of somebody with chronovision, we're going to have some technical department where quantum invasions of privacy, both physical and remote, are going to have to be policed to be prohibited. But in the area of mind control, the implication is it's one thing to shut down rogue elements who are in possession of, you know, $150,000 worth of entrainment equipment, but how do you police it out of existence or legislate it out of existence when it involves nanoparticles that have been distributed in people's bloodstreams? I mean, we'd have to have some kind of civil war where the non-replicants killed off the replicants, and that would be a nightmare scenario that I don't think we want to explore. So I don't know. Maybe we're beyond intervention at this point. I just don't know. But, I mean, it's something that's so large and so complex, you know, satisfying two of Bertrand Russell's postulates about what makes something problematic, that I don't think it doesn't lend itself to a superficial analysis or to glib discussion. I mean, it seems like, I mean, I pledge that if I become president, I'm going to ban chemtrail spraying on my first day in office via executive order. What if they then have a PhD from Harvard and, you know, in meteorology, and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs meet with me and say, if we don't do this, we're going to have an ice age that's going to involve reglaciation down to the southern Kansas border.
Well, you could just put them on the kill list and throw them into Guantanamo Bay.
Well, I might say something like, well, prove it to me, or I'm going before the people and telling them that. If they're going to be suffering the chemtrail-related bronchial asthma I've had for the last 8 years, they damn well deserve to be told why they're being respiratorily poisoned. The other solution would be to say, you know, fuck you guys. I'm gonna risk an ice age just so we have blue skies and clean air. And if you try to stop me, I'll put you in prison. And if you evade being arrested, I'll have the people chasing you shoot you. You know, that's the only solution I see, because it looks like when people get in office as president, like Bush and Obama, because they're the wrong personalities, because they're people who want to be popular rather than morally lead, they quickly knuckle under and do what the apparatus tells them to do. And so I'm pledged, first off, not to do that, to basically say, okay, if you want to poison our skies across the planet, tell me why it's necessary. Okay, if it's necessary, why haven't the people been told? That's certainly not where we're at. So I think there's an analogy there to the area of, you know, this advanced psycho-civilization type stuff that's going on, psycho-civilizing stuff that's being tried. But I don't think it lends itself to a ready solution. Like in the case of Perfield or Irwin, I would have to spend tens of thousands of dollars just trying to detect where they were at a particular time and where they got brainwashed. In the case of Perfield, the only thing I found out that made any sense is that his father told me that in January of 2010, he was a longtime patient at a Kaiser Permanente facility. And I know from Captain Ernest Garcia, who was the Army security attaché to Project Pegasus, that Kaiser Permanente is used as a kind of a eugenics laboratory by the U.S. military. They probably killed my mother, by the way. And here's how deeply embedded all this stuff is. My mother was probably killed by the chemotherapy and radiation that Kaiser gave her after she had a single mastectomy in 1997. She died in 2003. Well, three of her five children work for Kaiser, and her other two children are independently employed professionals. So right there in my own family, there's a 3-2 bias against independence and freedom. I've got three siblings who are literally made members of the eugenics laboratory that Kaiser's running. When I worked at Kaiser after law school in their editorial department, I have never met a group of completely insane, rigid, lunatic, and fascist colleagues in my entire life. They were just absolutely intolerant, conservative, timid, weird people. So this is the problem. We have all these mass institutions that are filled with the shadow of free people. I'm not calling my siblings that. They're fairly robust, but you know, this is part of one of the main problems I have for people even considering the truth that I'm sharing, is that the pressures towards conformity are so strong in contemporary society that people fear believing the truth when they hear it, for fear that they're endangered somehow if they step out of the thought pattern. So I think it's going to take several generations, but it's going to have to begin with people stepping up and trying to take political control who are absolutely dedicated to the truth, because that's where it's got to start. But I don't think it's going to be solved except after maybe, I don't know, three U.S. presidential administrations who are dedicated to that kind of process, because it's so pervasive and complex that how do you even get a handle on the phenomenology of it? You know, if I can't track down who brainwashed, or not, that's what we got subject to is brainwashing, not brainwashing, who mind controlled Kevin Perfield to think that I was the most fascinating person on the planet, and he had to move from Sacramento to Portland to meet me. And he had to call me every day six times and send 10 emails to me every day. If I can't do that with the resources of being an attorney, is it you know possible that the U.S. presidential administration could even find where some of these projects are going on? Some of these programs are absolutely rogue and completely cut off from presidential and congressional scrutiny. You know, who's killing off all the biochemistry researchers? Could that actually surface in a truth amnesty process? You know, I was an assassin of biochemistry PhDs, you know, who might provide solutions to epidemic diseases, you know? I don't know. It's just so complex and so pervasive that I just don't know whether it could be solved, except maybe in several very highly functioning administrations.
Look how many years of collusion to set up the system. Hundreds of years, maybe even thousands, some people reckon, in order to facilitate this agenda and bring the world to the way it is now. There's an old saying in Zen Buddhism, I believe. It's fruit takes a long time to ripen, but it drops very quickly. You never know.
What about the fact that the mean IQ in the States, for example, is 107? So for every 99 people who think they're thinking in a contemporary way, by believing that the Roswell incident occurred and it involved extraterrestrials, you've got one person who has any conception of the possibility that the UFO crash and crash retrieval stories have been propagated to conceal ET human liaison going on in the very same state. But in fact, we know from my account and the account of others that in fact, before the Roswell incident even became a current kind of subject in this general population, the U.S. government was in liaison with at least one extraterrestrial species. So even in the alternative media, shallow memes keep on being propagated so that the true nature of things remains concealed. I think that's intentional, and I think it involves things like, if you look at, let's say, a program like Coast to Coast AM, the propagators of those false memes have been the regular guests, the Linda Moulton Howes, the Ed Dames, and so forth. Many of those individuals have ties secretly to the military. George Norrie has never discussed his 9 years in the Navy. Art Bell never went into the fact that he was born of two Marine Corps drill instructors at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. Ed Dames has never discussed his work for the defense technical community on Project Pegasus and on the Mars Jump Room program, where I worked with him in both cases. So you have these people who become the apparent spokespersons for the alternative view of reality, which is putatively more deep or more real, more realistic or accurate. But in fact, they're gatekeepers for the false memes. So the net effect is that everybody knows about Roswell, but nothing about the fact that we should look askance at the UFO crash stories, because creatures that have been sophisticated enough to come here from distant star systems are clearly not going to be knocked out of the sky by radar. And there is as powerful evidence regarding the existence of ET human liaison programs going on. So again, you know, the way in which people's minds are opened often results in an alternatively shallow view of reality, but not in the truth. So again, the mass public keeps on being cheated and deceived. And so that's part that's actually an example to inform the truth-seeking process that the truth amnesty leadership needs to remember. You know, we're not looking to reify Roswell type stories or stories of the superficiality and the magnitude, the disinformation magnitude of Roswell. That's what Bassett and company did in the citizen hearing, right? They achieved nothing in terms of advancing the discussion of the post-war ET situation because, for one thing, they're hostile to claimants like me that go into the issues of, for example, the ET human liaison or somebody like Dan Burrage. But that's the reality of what happened, is we were in liaison with extraterrestrials after we began blowing up atomic bombs, not picking up their UFOs. In fact, I think that Doug Dietrich has made a very convincing case for the notion that the Roswell space vehicle was a Japanese secret weapon that crashed with diminutive Japanese aviators aboard, and that the weird writing was in fact Japanese. But anyway, this is the problem. I mean, if I become president in 2016 or 2020, and I sponsor a truth amnesty process, you know, if there's a revelation of a Roswell magnitude event, we're going to get some snickering. But if we really go into something as sensitive as ET human liaison, then suddenly all of those operatives in the mass media become just cheap shot artists, right? What is this president thinking, that our government was in liaison with extraterrestrials? We didn't just pick up a couple of their crashed UFOs every once in a while? See, they're just going to do another number on that kind of sarcasm that they're so good at. And that sways a lot of people who are more concerned about baseball games.
This reminds me, Alfred, you still there?
The
Canadian, there was a Canadian defense minister who just came out recently saying that they were in contact with ETs and UFOs. Did you hear about that?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Paul Hellyer actually was introduced into the whole ET field and actually came out when he wrote an introduction to my book, Exopolitics, which Andy edited and which is published in 2005, which Andy actually first saw in 1971 because it was physically time traveled back from 2005 back to 1971. And Paul Hellyer, who I met here in Vancouver in the year 2001 to talk to him about arms and space treaty, and then began to talk to him about this field, actually bridged into this field and at his first speech read a passage from my book. This was in Toronto in at the University of Toronto in 2005 or 2006, I think. And as kind of segue to what Andy was saying, so that just to finish my point, what Andy was saying is that what was presented at the citizen hearing was old news. Paul has been saying that since 2006, so it was old news. And just this past week, the fellow who gave $1 million to put on the citizen hearing, which I co-founded 10 years ago in 2003 with Stephen Bassett, on the condition that people like Andy would be allowed to testify there. Anyway, this lawyer here in Vancouver, Tom Clearwater, called up, asked to meet with me. And when I confronted him with the fact that, hey, you just put $1 million behind a concept that was just promoting old and disinformational memes from the 50s and 60s. He literally back out of the meeting. So you have a whole cadre of I'd like to call them robotized humans, and I will segue into that, like Greer, Bassett, and
remember, we've come up with a new term for those people. They're called robotussins, but continue.
Yeah, robotussins. And who are taking large sums of money from other people who are unwilling to to engage in due diligence and do thoughtful grantsmanship. And they have easy access to the mainstream media because, of course, the mainstream media is controlled by their equals. Now, what we did, and the people in the chat can go to exopolitics.com, because what we wanted to do was create a database where people can actually go to this, and we put together four different videos that are now circulating on the internet, and these are videos of three of the key witnesses at the citizen hearing: Steve Bassett, Stephen Greer, and Antonio Junius, who is a Rockefeller-funded witness from a UN family. And all of them in the videos, you can go there and see them, show anomalous eye movements and body part movements. That is, their tongues, their necks, their fingers bend in half in anomalous ways. And so you can see clearly that this sort of brain entrainment is taking place, whereby they're communicating certain frequencies and information on this, you know, worldwide televised thing before these six congressmen. I sent a lengthy letter to the senator there, who the senator from Alaska, trying to get his name here, Senator Mike. Do you recall that, Andy?
I couldn't get my unmute mic. Mike Gravel.
Mike Gravel. And I sent a letter to him prior to the Senate citizen hearing, because he and I had been on a panel on Press TV about 18 months prior. And I said, you know, you're being significantly led. You're being significantly misled by the citizen hearing and by Bassett and these other proposed witnesses, because you're being misled as to the true nature of U.S. Martian and U.S. extraterrestrial relations. And I provide a lot of the background documentation. And he personally wrote back and said, thank you. But then didn't, you know, he took his $20,000 and, you know, said, well, we can't do anything. Let's kick it up to the UN, so we'll have more global. We'll do more baffle garb on the global population. So people can go to exopolitics.com and actually see these videos where you can look at the anomalous eye and body part movements and see the effects of the brain mind entrainment that is caused by the brains of these witnesses being entrained actually into these global, into these super grids. And they are, part of the transhumanist agenda. And I'm sure that the person who put up the funding, who actually contacted me, and I invited him to tea at my home, and he canceled 3 days ago because he read these articles. And I said, well, didn't you do due diligence before you gave your $1 million? And he just, you know, clammed up. These are the sort of things which are happening in kind of the implementation of the quote New World Order. Now, we we progressive forces that are listening to this chat and this broadcast and that are tuned in to this information are now aware of what's happening. I'm coming to believe that people on the other side, that these populations are even deaf, dumb, and blind as to what we're saying. They might even not understand exactly what we're saying, you know, and can't recognize what we're saying. So this demands a new form of strategy and kind of, you know, sort of overleaping them in a certain way, you know, getting out of the evolutionary cul-de-sac that the robotoids, that the robotized population is driving itself into. And that actually comes from a week-long closed seminar that I attended back in the 70s with Gregory Bateson, who was one of the husbands of Margaret Mead. And we talked about, you know, humanity's getting into an evolutionary cul-de-sac and how we could get out of that. Well, that is, those are the types, I think, that being faced with the transhumanist agenda and with being able to see phenomena in each field, like I'm just pointing to the phenomena in the U.S., in the UFO ET quote disclosure area, we can see that there's an opinion leadership, like the Citizen Hearing, like the Bassetts, the Greers, that are robotic, and that are, you know, leading humanity off a cliff, and that we now have to, we sentient human beings now have to self-organize and move beyond them. And maybe that's what's referred to in such biblical verses as, and brother shall rise against brother. You know, I'm just, and that's an allusion back to Andy's tale about three of the brothers that were with Kaiser and two are, you know, not. And, you know, I just wanted to share those thoughts that in these are new and challenging times. It's not like the discourse of World War II times, where you had the Third Reich and the Axis, and you know it was fairly clear. The New World Order is an internal New World Order. It is who is allowing their body and soul to be taken over and co-opted. And it seems as though we're going to have to begin to appeal to our fellows by soul signal, by vibration, by living light, and by these signals that those who are in the armies of the dark, those who are in the who are controlled by the supergrids, do not hear. And we're going to have to be smart enough to get in there and wrest from them the control of the computerized voting systems, because the computerized voting systems were taken over by the same admiral who from SAIC who was charged with implementing the Total Information Awareness Program.
Well, that doesn't sound very admirable.
Right, exactly. So these are going to be you know, times that will require extraordinary measures and talents on at all levels, in my judgment.
That was Admiral John Poindexter, by the way, Alfred.
Yes.
Who was the discredited admiral from the Iran-Contra scandal.
Yeah. To me, as a person who has been informally in the exopolitics field since 73, making this the 40th year that I've been in it, and formally when I published the exopolitics model on the internet in the year 2000, this is 13th year, and I've watched its infiltration over the last decade by people, by individuals, entities like Greer and Bassett, where I've gotten all sorts of signals from people, gee, these people aren't quite right. And it's now with the technology and with data, like we've been able to put these combination of their anomalous eye and body movements plus the policies that they're putting forward, we can identify them as part of an agenda which is controlled by a bloodline and dimensional power matrix that is manipulatory and not in the best interest of the progressive human race. So I now, as a goal, and I've publicly said this, my goal is to rid exopolitics of the corruption and the infiltration that has entered it over the last 10 to 20 years. And I focused on Greer and on Bassett as two sort of symptoms of them. I call them the two Steves. And that's been my goal this year, is to deconstruct their roles and to show them for what they are, that they're not truly practicing authentic exopolitics, but rather are stalking horses and puppets and implementers of an agenda that is about alien control, both alien in terms of bloodlines and perhaps alien in terms of a manipulatory dimensional agenda.
Alfred, let me jump in there, because I want to hit several exopolitical points that I think are related to what you just stated. I want to point out that Alfred has taken his drubs in the exopolitical community, actually from people of lesser stature to the extent that he's the founder of the field, by affirming and defending my Mars finding. And the irony here, and I think this goes to the control issue and what the agenda really is that all that I've postulated, all that I have stipulated is that Mars is inhabited. I've described the life forms. Others have done so as well. And then I've tried to synthesize what we know about Mars based on the narration of the experiences of the jumpers. Now, in the modern era of ufology, the emphasis has been on advanced hominids from distant star systems. The implicit assumption of that prevailing meme, the meme that would be advanced by a Greer or a Bassett or a Sala, is that we have to focus on the sophisticated hominids, the grays, if you will. And the notion that's implicit is that what we have to focus on is visits to our planet by biological entities from distant star systems. In the construction of that meme, the question is never asked, and I've been trying to pose it. Well, even if we were to assume arguendo that the creatures coming here are from distant star systems, you thereby imply some other concepts that are embedded into that notion, like the fact that the other planets in our solar system aren't inhabited, or that their inhabitants wouldn't come here or have come here, that clearly the ETs that you say are coming here are in possession of time travel. They'd also have to have biological modifications that we don't have, so that you're really saying ultimately that we're not being visited by biological entities from our own star, our own solar system, but we're being visited by interdimensional in time ships rather than extraterrestrial biological entities in spaceships. But at the same time, you're stipulating that they're EBEs because that meme comes up in the literature. Now, if we track back to the major input of this concept, I would aver that it originated in the star map that Marjorie Fish did based on the abduction testimony of Betty Hill. That's where the notion of the Zeta Reticuli, the Zeta meme, entered the UFO literature. Now, if you look at the UFO literature itself, it's almost devoid of any information, any true information, of where the more advanced creatures are from. A professional liar like Ralph Agerman, who uses the stage name Alex Collier, would assert that he can tell you which are Lyrians and which are Pleiadians, which are Orions, and which are Sirians. But when I was serving in Project Pegasus, that wasn't known, nor was the agenda of the extraterrestrials visiting us known, even the ones that were guests of the U.S. government. So we have something very strange that is inherently embedded in the position of Greer and Bassett in the way that they constructed the citizen hearing, which is they won't allow testimony about life on Mars when Mars is a neighboring planet of ours, that just in a bunkhouse logic kind of way, you could say, well, wouldn't it be more likely that we would be visited by planetarians from neighboring planets rather than time travelers from distant star systems? Isn't that just common sense? And if you're going to admit that we could be visited by Pleiadians or Lyrians or Sirians or Orions, doesn't that mean that there's even a higher likelihood that we maybe have been visited or in contact with Martians? I mean, come on, guys. I guess what I'm saying is their inherent resistance to the Mars meme lacks logical and historical integrity. And just by putting that out there, there was a vowed professional hostility directed at Alfred and myself, particularly Alfred as the founder of ExoPolitics, which is unfair. So now what I think is going on here is that once the extraterrestrial interstellar visitor meme, the focus on the physically modified, you know, advanced, sophisticated, genetically sophisticated extraterrestrial meme entered the UFO literature through Marjorie Fish's star map based on the Betty Hill abduction transcript, that any discussion of more conventional-looking hominids from that look more like us from other planets was relegated to the realm of the George Adamski case and the fella from Venus. His name escapes me right now. Thor, Valiant Thor. Now, Venus
right.
is six.
Yes.
Venus is 600 degrees Fahrenheit on the surface. So if we're being visited by Venusians, they must be flame resistant and not like us biologically. But the Martians that my dad and I met at a New Jersey air base in the summer of 70 were very much like us. So there seems to be an embedded bias towards the less likely probability. In other words, the probability that inherently needs to establish more to prove itself, which is that we're being visited by highly sophisticated creatures that would be more like interdimensional rather than extraterrestrial beings coming here in devices that are more or less time ships rather than spaceships. Now, when again, this came up in the context of the citizen hearing, again, the robotoids, again, these kind of mind-controlled activists like Bassett, like Greer, like Dolan. I'll tell you what Richie Dolan told me recently. When I met him at UFOCon in Santa Clara in September of last year, they're wedded to basically a more complex explanation. I think it's all of the above. I think that many of the abduction, my own contact experiences and many of the other abduction and, you know, contact encounters that literally millions of people have had indicate that sophisticated interdimensional or, you know, galactic sophisticated creatures are visiting us. But what they won't allow is any discussion of the extraterrestrial questions, which are most sensitive, which is what are we going to do about and towards our planetary neighbors? I mean, when they had us sequestered there in the jump room training in 1980, the CIA didn't ask Barry Obama and Regina Dugan and I, two individuals that they had identified as future presidents and one that they had identified as a future highly placed Defense Department official. They didn't ask us what we thought of the Zetas. They gave us 4 inches of documents about the Martian humanoids. So internally, the intelligence community is more concerned about our local neighbors, who we're more at technical parity with. And I think they assume, well, you know, because we're also being visited by these very advanced, sort of genetically evolved, more genetically involved, more knowledgeable, you know, more capable galactic visitors, we'll sort of only focus on what we can affect, which is our relationship with the Martians. So I think people have to be challenged about the logical suppositions that are embedded in their positions. Because in fact, if exopolitics had evolved without this influence from ufology, both the near and the close visitors would have equal standing. They're visitors to our planetary civilization, whether they come from Mars or Zeta Reticuli, they're here or they've been here. But this is where these issues break down, and I think the issue is conforming. And let me just say, when we're talking about this, I thought of the only two individuals that I know that reached Harvard Law School, which is a very advantageous law school to attend in terms of your professional prospects and so forth, were Barack Obama and one of my UCLA classmates named Ben Vandiver. Ben became general counsel for Guthy Renker, which is the marketing arm of Tony Robbins, the self-help guru, Anthony Robbins. And they've sold Vanessa Williams' Proactive Solution and these other kind of mass-marketed things on infomercials. I think they were selling Kevin Trudeau stuff at one point. Ben is now worth like $20 million. He owns 16 homes, 2 Learjets. But because I knew both of them when we were young men, you know, college-age men, they're very similar personalities. They're both fairly tall. They're very effective in that cocktail party setting at getting people to like them and not be offended by them. And they're basically geniuses at signaling to people that they like and agree with other people, and they never have taken controversial positions. So one of our impediments here is that the individual autonomy and integrity that has characterized the activist individuals that we study in college, you know, your Frederick Douglass, that degree of outspokenness and integrity to the truth is what is being repressed in modern society. And the individuals who are skillful at never taking a position, look at Obama. He didn't even write a law review article when he was president of the Harvard Law Review. That kind of conformity is what is in the saddle and riding mankind at this point. We're evolving not just into a psycho-civilized society in some sophisticated ways, but just culturally into a society where those who become leaders or who become wealthy people, if they're not from means when they're born, are those who are skillful at conformity. They're the individuals who get straight A's in law school because they parrot the professor. And that's what has defined the baby boom generation. And because I stand between the baby boomers and the Gen Xers are no better. The issue even with the baby boomers has been conformity. They said they were dropping out when they were wearing their hair long and wearing blue jeans everywhere, but everybody was dropping out, growing their hair long, smoking dope, and wearing blue jeans to work. The baby boomers have been a very conformist generation. By the time they reached their 40s, they had to keep up with everybody else just in what Apple Macintosh computer they were buying. Okay, so part of this is just the descent into a very, very conformist society where if you ever try to influence the thinking of other people by being a person of moral genius, you are repressed by your enabling environment, by your family members, your friends, your neighbors, your employers, your educators, your clergy, and everybody in your life. I mean, what a sad state of affairs that Harvard Law School that produced somebody like a Ralph Nader produced a Ben Vandiver and a Bennett Vandiver and a Barack Obama. Ben and Barry were two of the most gutless individuals I've ever met in my whole life. And they reached the same distinguished, powerful law school. So that's a major part of this here. When I would listen to Mae Brussel when I was in college, I would think, you know, I don't know if I'd want a career like this woman. She seems so lonely. You know, she was the daughter of Rabbi Edgar Magnin of Los Angeles, and so he was a very wealthy and powerful rabbi in the L.A. Jewish community. So she could have had a life of ease, but she decided to do things like investigate who shot President Kennedy and why and so forth, whether the Nazis had regrouped in after Paperclip and so forth. And I think gradually through the positive influence like people like Alfred, I've become a person of greater integrity than I thought I would when I was a young man. But it's resulted in being virtually broke all the time, and also to some extent stressed by the fact that we don't live in a truth-seeking culture. We live in a culture that existed around the time of the American Revolution, where only 6% of the colonists took up arms to free themselves from British tyranny. I think that's about where we are numerically. We may think that that's not the case, but look at how many people are concerned about the World Series rather than whether Barack Obama was in the secret space program. So I don't want to get depressed because I'm kind of tired right now, but I'm just saying that that's a major issue here, is how do we electrify the public so that becoming a truth seeker and a truth teller is fashionable? That's what I'll try to do as I'm running for president. And if I win the presidency, that's what I'll try to do as president. I'll also try to deconstruct the behavior of the president. Like, I might sit down and interview a foreign leader rather than do a photo opportunity, right? Or like President Kennedy did with Eleanor Roosevelt. You know, have somebody come in and interview me who's like a major intellectual, rather than just doing all this phony stuff at press conferences. Or say, no, I don't know when I don't know something, rather than bullshit like they always did. So I'll try to deconstruct this, the conformity of not seeking the truth, because this, in fact, is what the peril is to our civilization at this time. Even you know, advocating teleportation, people say things to me like, "Do you really think we're going to give up our cars?" And I say, "Are you really happy getting, you know, scarfing your Egg McMuffin while you get on a 4-lane freeway on your side of the freeway, an 8-lane freeway in Southern California? Do you want to live in a 24-lane freeway? Do you want to die with an Egg McMuffin lodged in your esophagus while getting in a car accident? Or will you enjoy cannibalizing a fellow motorist when the whole city stops and you're all there on the freeway and nobody can move for days? What are you going to do, light yourself on fire with your gas tank gasoline?" You know, the whole grid could potentially stop as a result of the limits of growth. Every time they put a new freeway on a new lane on a freeway in California, it fills up with cars in 30 days. So many of the designs that are frozen in the 70s will become unusable, impracticable when as time progresses. But I still get all these people who smugly think that this automobile-based culture can survive, and it can't. It has to hit the limits to growth, whether that's oil depletion or spatial depletion or congestion. It has to happen. We're going to be adding 2 billion people in the next 30 years. How are we going to provide life support for them? So there's a great deal of sort of smugness that, as if we're not living in an unsustainable situation, and we are. So I don't believe the solution is to go to the woods and live as a survivalist, because ultimately all of us have to die. You know, there's no point in trying to save your life when it's not directly threatened. But I'm just amazed that people think that, even though their life has been, I mean, when I was at UCLA, the commute time between my parents' house and UCLA doubled between 1980 and 84. That wasn't exactly a happy reality, but there's never any discussion in the mass media. And I think that one of the things they do with these psycho-civilized shooters on the school grounds and so forth, is the main theme is the old Charles Manson theme, right? Riders on the Storm, you know, there's a killer on the road, his mind is hopping like a toad. When the long-haired activists like your John Lennons and your Jim Morrisons began trying to embed the truth into popular music, what did they give us? They gave us Charles Manson. And so what they use these elements for is to brainwash the population into not trusting and relying on their fellow human beings, which is part of the psycho-civilizing of society, is, you know, you're safer in the presence of a cop than a neighboring motorist. Well, in fact, I don't think you are. But anyway, so So I'm going to try to do unconventional things as president that will start to break that down. You know, I might go into somebody's living room and talk to them, you know, somebody in Ohio and what concerns them, or like a town hall meeting that's authentic. You know, have my worst critic in, or you know, bring a group of British journalists into the White House and say, listen, why are you asking me all these tough questions when you're not even urging the overthrow of your oligarchical monarchy there in the United Kingdom? You know, how could your Christopher Hitchens come over here and be full of all these bromides about what's wrong with American society when you're all living in that imprisoned island over there with that oligarchical Hanoverian German family that owns 25% of the planet? Why are you focusing on poor old me when I'm only going to be president for 4 years and then go off and do other stuff, and you're living in basically in a totalitarian monarchical nightmare? Just say it to them right there on the open camera. You know, I'm happy to have Joe Bloggs from the BBC, you know, Helen, what's her name, from BBC2 on radio, blah, 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 and just tear into them about the fact that there's never any confrontation by Britons about their enslavement in an oppressive, monarchical, totalitarian state. When I was in Britain as a Cambridge student, I couldn't even get citizens to talk to me. You know, they were that repressed and culturally and oppressed politically. You know, so anyway, I'm going to do a series of unconventional things like that to try to shake people up. But I don't know. Maybe they'll shoot me like they shot JFK. Who knows?
Perhaps they'll just be too afraid to ruin their employment opportunities as the groomer of the stool.
Absolutely, but they've already started. You know, I identify Barack Obama as one of our Mars jumpers, and the Colbert Report portrays he and I as gay lovers. I mean, come on. The attacks on me have begun before I even formally announced for president. So what does that tell you? I had that interview with...
At least you'll have some free press in that one, because at least people will know you. People are far more likely to vote for people they've heard of than people they haven't heard of, even if the person that they've heard of is they've heard bad things.
Yeah, maybe I'll get the gay vote, and that 10% will put me over the top. I don't know. It could have an inapposite result.
You could play it like Lucy Lawless and Xena Warrior Princess, and just kind of keep it ambiguous so that you get both the straight and lesbian audiences listening.
Yeah, maybe that's a part of like the magic formula for winning. And then Matt Markovich, then the Seattle ABC affiliate, ends a very fair and balanced report by suggesting that I'm either, you know, I practiced law in the state for 16 years without a client complaint, and he suggested that I was either a pathological liar, a sociopath, or the fastest talking science fiction writer on the planet. So I wrote him an email that said, hey, Matt, what about this quote from you? I've always thought that a sociopathic lawyer would be more like a Ted Bundy. A sociopathic Washington State lawyer in private practice would be somebody more like Ted Bundy. What do you think? So anyway, just the pressures towards conformity are just absolute at this point. I mean, if the lunar landing had been carried out in secret, people would be disparaging Neil Armstrong. Really, truly, there's no way that those two guys could have convinced the public that they had stepped foot on the moon for the first time. The mass public, at least.
So, whether or not the masses even matter, and a friend of mine just posted up this picture on Facebook about democracy, and it's got a group of gangsters hiding around a corner and a really pretty girl walking down the other side of the road coming towards them, and it says, democracy, I've taken a vote, and guess what? And this is basically the what it really comes down to, is that democracy doesn't really work in a lot of things. I mean, I wonder whether or not the masses and their votes and everything even matter anymore, because they're so mind-controlled and brainwashed that any decisions that they make would only be decisions that they were told to make or influenced to make and under Bernaysian propaganda techniques anyway.
Well, let me follow up on that, Vinny. The intelligent population that disparages the CIA and CIA operatives like my father, they believe, as a result of leftist propagation of ideas, let's say at the university level, that that members of my dad's generation that were in OSS or continued and then or were taken up by one of the alphabet soup intelligence agencies, they believed that they reified intelligence community secrecy because they were right-wingers or fascists, but they were never told that individuals like my dad, who were brought into secret projects, were doing so under the threat that if they revealed their secrets, they and their family members might be killed to make examples of them. So what I'm saying here is the left kind of dropped the ball at the level of intelligent discourse in the West, because it didn't reveal what my old professor Sandy Cohen at UCLA used to talk about, which was fascism with a happy face. So a set of shallow memes was introduced about how sinister the emergence of the CIA really was. I mean, we've had very intelligent intellectuals take on what a disaster it was to form the CIA. I mean, Gore Vidal was certainly an articulate critic of CIA during his life, you know, the latter part of his life. But I'm suggesting that we didn't really describe to the activist intelligent population, you know, that let's say that activist 6 or 7%, it didn't know what a fraction of a percent of the population knew about how the intelligence community in the West is really organized. That if, for example, you were brought into secret projects like the ones that my dad was, and you spoke openly about what you were doing with your family members or at some 4th of July picnic with the neighborhood behind somebody's house, that there were examples that were made of people who did blab, where not just they, but their entire families were killed. So what my point here is that the enforcement of state secrecy was done at the barrel of a gun, not because individuals like my dad were Nixon Republicans who were, you know, too anally retentive to be truth-oriented. So, for example, that home invasion in Rancho Santa Fe, California, where that man connected to that Israeli software program, that was one of the rub-outs they did of a whole family staged as a home invasion robbery of somebody who had blabbed about what he was working on for the defense technical community. So that's part of the problem, is that the really sinister nature of the things that have been done to maintain this intelligence community-driven conspiracy have kind of been touched on to some extent in terms of the seriousness and the cynicism by some of the leading researchers like your Mae Brussels. But I don't think even they imagined how sinister the reality has really been. I mean, my dad was concealing my involvement in things that could have killed me from his wife and my 4 siblings, even though he deeply loved me. But he and I were caught in something so much larger than ourselves that he couldn't. And here was a man who was so courageous personally that I saw him charge a brown bear to protect his children and his wife when we were in Quebec, Canada, camping in the early 70s. So that's something that people don't grok. They'll get a kind of a conspiracy story will be floated about all the dead biochemists. But people won't realize that it wasn't the fact that they were conservatives or Republicans that individuals like my dad didn't talk. It was because they knew that they were endangering their children if they did. So that's why my dad set me up to be a truth teller, to get the information outside the puzzle palace in a way that wouldn't jeopardize his children. And I think that was an honorable thing to do. He would like tell Connie to say something to me, and then his friend Connie Chavez, and then she would talk to me at poolside about what I was going to do when I grew up. So they were kind of using me as a conduit to get the information out to the public 40 years later. So that's part of the story. So I just wanted to share that because my dad was a moral, loving, and responsible human being, and he was trying to use different techniques to get this information to the mass public. Because among other things, he believed that we should use Tesla teleportation for human transport, for civilian transport. And I think he was right. I think we're going to have to. But anyway, so my point here is that even on the left, even among the conspiracy minded, there's been a shallowness of the analysis and the factuality of what's been behind this stuff. So, for example, in Alfred's example, where nanotechnology has been introduced to spread technologies to basically roboticize people, that may have been a situation where people were told that, if they didn't help on that project, they would be assassinated. And that's no more advanced than, atrocities that Idi Amin committed in Uganda. You know, beat to death the guy next to you with a hammer, you know, or Saddam Hussein isolating people in the audience to be taken out and shot. So anyway, so that's that means really that we have to be ready to die for what we're doing, and we have to encourage other people to say, look, if you are killed as a result of being this kind of dynamic element in society, that's a more honorable way to die. You have to die at some point, and you go on to a different existence. You know, other people in the past have accepted such risks. I use the example in my lectures of General George Washington having four horses shot out from underneath him, or wearing a cloak that had what do you call them? Not a cloak, but a cape with four musket holes in it. So, you know, Washington was fortunate to have survived the Revolutionary War. He was almost killed a number of times. He just turned his horse at the right minute to avoid a musket ball. So, anyway, that's what I think we have to propagate, too, is a return to the heroic model that in adulthood there are things worth dying for. In a conformist culture, that's an idea that people have gotten away from.
People have gotten into this this era of selfishness, I think, obsessed with the self and what I'm doing, who I am. And now, I don't think that that's necessarily inherently a bad thing if you're just thinking about yourself, because let's say for my personal example, I think that I'm a very fun person to be around, and I think that I do really important work. But I understand that despite my my own sense of self-importance, that I'm only one of many people on this planet who talks about and does really important shit. Therefore, I'm looking at my own importance out of a sense of context. What I think the general public's problem is that they've lost that perspective of context. They don't really understand their importance in the broader spectrum of society, and they only think about their importance to themselves and only themselves, and everybody else doesn't really matter. That has to change.
Right. Yeah, there's kind of a budget of risk. I'll obey the laws and do my job and see that paycheck shows up every few weeks. But if there's any extension of the self, I will choose not to extend myself because I don't need to, and I'm putting myself at risk that I don't need. So the net effect is you have a curtailing of people doing the difficult and the heroic things that advance society. I think it was Sir Patrick Geddes or Ebenezer Howard, one of the famous city planning progenitors, who noted that it's really the difficult or twisty kind of personality that makes a difference, like a Nikola Tesla. It's the person who imposes unnecessary problems on themselves that do the magnitudinous things that advance the human condition. I would think that would be a personality like Brett Stillings. I mean, Brett may be the individual who develops the chronovisor that's then taken back in time to brief Renetti and Gemelli and bring it forward, you know? But I'm kind of concerned about that because, you know, if you look at these shills who constantly attack us, for example, on Facebook, I want to ask myself, has this person ever done anything that involves going beyond the ordinary expectation of their existence? Anything? Have they ever taken blankets to the homeless? You know, it's like, where do they come off as the censors and the judges of my life conduct? If they've never done anything in a voluntary position, how can they even relate to somebody who was involved in 8 years of government work for which I wasn't even paid or benefited in any way? It's just not even comparable. Oh, you lost your job. Well, what happened? You got another job, right, from another corporation. So what? I was enslaved by an ostensibly democratic society. So anyway, I'm sick of it. I'm at this point, I'm telling the flamers, I'm just basically telling them off or just blocking them. I'm sick of being harassed by people who have simply not paid any kind of price beyond their ordinary existence.
Myself as well.
Fact, you know?
I see that myself quite often as well. And I have to stop myself saying, do you know who I am? You know, do you know what I've suffered through, bro? You know, you're coming at me with all this stuff and you don't even know who I am, what I've done or anything like that. And then all of a sudden you're thinking you're better than me and that I'm not accomplishing anything. The thing that amuses me the most, Andrew, is when you're at a protest or you're out in public or something of that nature about some extremely important issue, like chemtrails or 9/11 being an inside job or Monsanto taking over the place. And you have these people going, ugh. You should just get a job. Now I laugh about it now, but at the time, there's this big swelling of rage. And it's just like, well, I could be a job and be a slave like you, do nothing for society or ignore everything that's important that's going on until it reaches up and bites me in the testes. I don't think so, bro.
Yeah. We can't digest our food because it's so genetically modified.
News report yesterday that China dumped three whole shiploads of genetically modified corn, citing that it was dangerous. Three whole shiploads.
Wow.
And what I found very interesting about that is none of the major media were reporting it. Isn't that a huge story?
Absolutely.
Indeed.
See, this is the system that we've got that is 100% broken. Now, I understand that both of you might be relatively tired here, so maybe keep it going for another 15 minutes or so, round off a good 2-hour conversation, and then let you get back to bed. How does that sound?
Sounds very good. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Now, in terms of directing the discussion. Lots of people take 2 hours to talk about the problems and then about 15 minutes to address the solutions because the solutions are relatively simple and the problems oh so complex. What would your solutions be? Like, let's say you were God, in other words, President of the United States, with the power of God imposed by the banking cartels. How exactly, and I want to start with you, Alfred, how exactly would you change U.S. policy in order to make the country better?
Well, no, I would rather leave that in Andy's bailiwick. And since I'm a futurist, I'd like to advance and think about solutions that are kind of planetary. And one solution that I've been thinking about, which is really interesting to me and to others, is that now that we have the cybernetic security problem solved. I mean, I can remember back in the early 80s when Colonel Jim Channon, he's the guy who was in The Men Who Stare at Goats, Jim used to come by the house where I was staying in Washington, D.C., and give us printouts of DARPANET, which was what DARPA used when it developed the internet. So right now, most wars are run virtually online, and they're very, very secure. So this isn't like the consumer commercial internet, which can be hacked. So the technology exists to eliminate all forms of representative democracy, be it a monarchy, be it an emperor in terms of hereditary, or be it representative government. Representative government is a model that is now, 300, 400 years old. And that's where you elect representatives who go to a central parliament or Congress to supposedly represent your interests. And that model was developed when people traveled on horseback and in coaches. And now, people travel at the speed of light or more. So, and what happens when you have representative government is that the representatives inevitably get co-opted by the powers that be. So the people always lose out. And so the ideal form of government, which is technologically feasible, I think, would be universal direct democracy. And that is where the people vote directly on issues, and you have a civil service that carries out the governmental functions. And that's sort of my ideal of how things should function. And you can have this at the planetary level, at the nation state level, at the provincial or state level, at the municipal level. So you won't have city councilors that get bought off. You just have all of the citizens, you know. And this is really based on the Swiss canton model of government, where the Swiss village, the canton, they all gather in the village square, and one person, one vote, and they debate the issues, and you don't have a city councilor, and they all vote. And that, I think, is purest politics. And through the miracle of technology that exists now, that can be done. Now, you can ask, how do we get to there from here? Well, those are very, very good questions. And there are a number of steps that can happen to get to there from here. And one, I think, would be the elimination of the present money system, specifically the current private banking system, where functionally one family that rules over 13 bloodline families, the Rothschild family, essentially owns everything functionally and controls the entire money supply. And it's entirely corrupt and corrupted and corrupting. And so the elimination of all debt, the elimination of all privately owned banking, the creation of money to be as a public utility, more in the nature of water or electricity, such that there's a planetary, everyone on the planet is entitled to a sustainable guaranteed income. So, you don't have to worry about survival. And you can go to the money store where you have a creative project to build things. And so gradually, I think, thereby we allow the creative genius of humans really to make this the paradise planet that it was designed to be. And we have gotten into this position because of covert alliances between bloodline families and monarchies that have been taken over by demonic entities, the so-called satanic Illuminati, that then have put their octopus into religions, the Vatican, the Church of England, others. And so the issue is how to bring this planet out of the satanic column into the column of light. And I've said very clearly that one of the ways is to stop electing the Rockefeller Rothschild crowd to public office. I mean, if people just continue to elect these people to public office, like the Obamas, like the Sarkozys, like the you know, Harpers, like the Prime Minister of England. These people are groomed to implement a satanic planet, and that we need to bring people to public office. So that's why we need to bring people like Andy Bashago and Alfred Weber to public office. And Andy has had information given to him as to his role as president of the United States. And my training has really been more, and focus has really been more at the planetary level, that the sort of the training that I got. So Andy has really thought about this in a systematic way, and I do not have any pre-identification, but I put this out a few months ago. I said, select me to be the Secretary General of the UN, and I will transform the institution. And I do that not in a jocular way, but to say, think about changing the entire, instead of having all of these satanic Illuminati in power, really start bringing in the truth movement into world, you know, world positions. And I, you know, as a Wall Street lawyer, I used to go regularly to the UN and use this law library for clients. And I was trained in international law at Yale, and I was a judge on the World Moot Court at the University of Virginia in the World Moot Court competition. So, and I was in the largest international law firm in the world, and that's been kind of my background. So, I'm, and of course, the Secretary General of the UN is an appointed position, and so I'm saying, I have no idea how to get to there from here, but I'm postulating that between now and 2020, 2016 or 2020, when Andy will be president of the United States, there will be an outside shock to the system, an outside shock to the world that will change everything to where it's feasible, like where a person like me could be Secretary General of the UN. And I believe that I'm capable, that I have the skills, both terrestrial and extraterrestrial, to be a competent and in fact to meet all of the new challenges at that level. So I'm putting it out here also. It's just kind of in the wish list, bucket list category.
And just a few more minutes to go. Andy, what are some of the basic things that you'd like to do as president? Let's say you were president of the world, and I think, Alfred, you actually touched on that, because it's about thinking about the whole planet, because it's not just the United States that is fracked by these terrible people. It's actually the whole planet.
Sure, that's very true. So I think my comment here would apply to both leadership of the United States and leadership of other countries, and indeed the planet. I have a more classical Athenian conception of politics. I believe that what afflicts America is not the absence of a plebeian form of direct democracy, as Alfred articulated it, necessarily, although I think a move to more plebeian direct democracy would be salutary. But I believe the problem is that the emergence of more of a Spartan form of democracy has overwhelmed an Athenian form of democracy. In a PhD thesis written by my old friend Tomislav Hahn, as his PhD dissertation in American history at the University of Southern California, Dr. Hahn tracks the fact that the framers of the U.S. Constitution actually were members of the property class, but more specifically, they had a concrete understanding that not just the successful, but the evolved human societies had been Athenian democracies, where elites were established based on the highest quality people. And that's, in fact, the confluence in government that the United States has seen, fortunately, during several periods of crisis, the revolutionary era, the Civil War, and then the progressive era, where there was also ultimately World War I and then World War II. So we've had four great eras of leadership in the United States where a more Athenian form of democracy flourished under pressure. So I would focus less on plebeian solutions and more on Athenian ones. And I think there's information that we have, evidence that we have, that that would be more advisable, because in fact, the mean IQ in the United States is 107. That means that half of the population falls below 107. And this population that we have is easily propagandizable to be more concerned about sports or some other distraction than what we're doing with the tax monies that are being collected from the people. What we're doing is, in fact, something very Spartan with their tax dollars. We're spending 59% of it on war rather than peace. So when I run for president, whether I was to be running for president or secretary general or president of the world, which indeed Barack Obama may become at some point, I'm going to focus on waging peace. When President Kennedy tried it, they killed him. But he was taking the American democracy in the right direction. So I would reduce defense spending to maybe 25% of the federal expenditures and invest in peace. That is to say, common global responses to war, poverty, ignorance, and disease, which President Kennedy identified as the common enemies of humankind. Now, that would be a more Athenian form of leadership, because without that, what you get basically is the permanent warfare economy as articulated by Alfred. So articulately, basically, we have a permanent secret government, the thrust of which is what my mentor at UCLA, Norman Cousins, talked about in his book, The Pathology of Power, which is basically a permanent secret government that is permanently involved in waging war. As an American, as somebody who grew up in New Jersey, where we weren't even locking our front doors at night, where every mother in my neighborhood was a surrogate mother, where there was no danger of me being killed or having a rocket fall on me from the sky or being molested or whatever when I walked to my public elementary school through the woods, I grew up in a different America than the one that has emerged. The American, from the point of view of people in other countries, has become the Nazi. The child in the developing country, when asked to identify an American, sees that American as the pilot in the Apache attack helicopter who has strafed his village and killed his best friend in the neighborhood and his mother or his best friend's mother and his siblings in these wars of foreign adventurism that the United States has been waging. So pursuing a policy of waging peace, the thrust of that has to be to wage an emergency program in new energy so that resource wars of the future that could happen will not happen, because we will have freed the world and certainly the already industrialized part of the world from dependence on Middle Eastern oil. And I would do everything to extract the United States from involvement in Middle Eastern politics, because I think it completely violates the wisdom of Washington in terms of avoiding entangling alliances. The thrust of the dynamic energy of the people of the United States shouldn't be on waging resource wars in the Middle East. It should be on using our genius and our resources to create a new energy paradigm. So one of my major decisions would be appointing somebody like Dr. Brooks Agnew as energy secretary. And Brooks has agreed to do that. I don't believe that plebeian democracy will work to achieve those kinds of goals. For example, the establishment of a Department of Peace, maybe first led by Secretary Dennis Kucinich or Secretary Marion Williamson, Secretary of the Department of Peace, because the population of the United States has been too easily propagandized to support the Spartan approach to democracy, which has emphasized permanent warfare and indeed ignoble acts of genocide overseas, which I'm profoundly troubled by as an American citizen who loves his country and doesn't believe that that's what the people of the United States are about. And I think to their credit, a lot of people from foreign countries who come to know Americans personally know that the American people are a great people, but there is a pathological cancer that has grown in the government of the United States as it has become a fascist militarily aggressive government. So I would wage peace. I would establish a, I would reduce defense spending and begin spending it on peace spending. I would establish a Department of Peace. I would put Athenian luminaries in every cabinet office and every department and agency directorship. And they would be people who have advocated peace, not people like Regina Dugan, my old jumping buddy back in the Mars jump room days, who in her TED lecture didn't reveal that she had been to Mars, but tried to impress all of us about DARPA by showing us a robotic hummingbird in the room. So I would populate my administration with people who have been peace activists on the highest levels of alternative politics during their careers. People like Alfred, like Ralph Nader, like Dennis Kucinich, like a Julie Stein, who put forth that brilliant Manhattan Project for the environment when she ran for president in 2012. I think she'd make a great head of the Environmental Protection Agency. So I don't really think that the problem is one of identifying the power of different entrenched powerful dynasties like the Rothschilds or the Rockefellers. Certainly we have to put people in office who will be antagonistic to that kind of oligarchical control of federal agencies, you know, agency capture by dynastic wealth, you know, the Jay Rockefeller syndrome, the Barry Rockefeller Obama syndrome, if in fact he's a Rockefeller. But I would more or less build on the Kennedy administration initiative in waging peace, rediscover it, and apply it on the highest level of political and intellectual warfare for peace. And also involve the world in that discourse and literally go before the UN and apologize for the fascist aggressions by the government of the United States, inform the people of the world that a new regime is in power and that we want to work with other countries to wage peace. So that would be my thrust. But I wouldn't necessarily say that direct democracy is the solution. I think the solution would be to have, you know, Alfred as our UN, as our Secretary of State or UN representative, and Brooks at Energy rather than some corporate energy lobbyist at Energy or some phony defender of the permanent warfare economy like Hillary Clinton at State. I basically believe in individuals, and I believe in the catalytic energy of not necessarily galvanizing the population to believe something, but by bringing it to government, truly transforming personalities, like I think Washington did, or Lincoln made that brilliant decision of populating his cabinet with his extremely brilliant adversaries, as Doris Kearns Goodwin showed in her book on Lincoln and his cabinet. So I would do that. I'm planning on waging peace and not apologetically. So I'll just actually let slip one initiative. If I'm elected president, I'm going to go to the leadership of China and say, listen, here's the situation. Your country and mine is clinging to a barbaric form of legal or juridical process, and that's something called capital punishment. I want to announce something. We'll probably win, you and I, whoever the premier is in China, the Nobel Peace Prize. But here's the deal. I want you to agree with my country to end capital punishment. We've been criticized for maintaining it while stating that we're the most advanced country in the world. You've been rightfully accused of shooting people in the back of the head in sports stadia for embezzling from their companies for non-capital offenses. I want to publicly handle this as a pro-social initiative, as a spontaneously emerging initiative through your leadership and mine in agreement that we should do this. And if you don't, I will call for an economic boycott of all of your products by the world. But I don't want to lead with that punitive measure. I'm not threatening you. I want to do it as a voluntary initiative between your administration and mine. And if they don't, I will then urge the banning of capital punishment in the United States, try to end it, and if we can get a plebiscite over it or congressional action, or I can get at least a plurality of or a majority of state governors to ban it, then I will start propagandizing regarding the countries that are retaining capital punishment. I could go on for 2 hours as to why capital punishment is wrong. It's not just morally wrong, it's wrong as a public policy or a legal instrument. But what I'm saying is I want to basically go to the countries that are still doing barbaric things, even our own country, For example, apologize to the UN for the wars of aggression the U.S. has just waged. Go to the Japanese and say, why should we be buying your cars when you're still killing dolphins? How does that work? Publicly go before the UN and identify the countries and groups that are engaged in white slavery. Example, Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia has been kidnapping Western children from their front lawns and back lawns since the 1950s, and we consider them an ally? A resource fiefdom owned by one family that's been kidnapping our children and forcing them into concubinage and domestic slavery in Saudi Arabia? Excuse me? I'm going to talk knowledge to power even if they kill me, because what's developed on our planet is pervasive fascism. And history teaches me that those countries that opposed fascism during the World War II era were on the side of the angels. And I want to be on the side of the angels. And so those are some of the things I'm going to do if I'm elected president.
Eloquent in its brevity. Thank you guys for joining us for an extra 2 hour extended interview. We'll put this up on the website alongside the extra hour that we did live on the Vinnie Eastwood show. And ladies and gentlemen, I very much hope you appreciate it. I certainly did, and also the visitors in the little chat room here. Hope you enjoyed it, being in on the action as it was happening live. So, Alfred Labremont Weber, his website is exopolitics.com. That's exo, like a skeleton, politics.com. And Andrew Brashago from projectpegasus.net. That's Pegasus as in the winged horse. Incidentally, he was promoting some kind of Greek form of government. All right. I think we're done here. Gentlemen, thank you very much.